This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield, and we're going to begin today's program with a story about something about as sci-fi as a flying car. Or maybe a machine that records your dreams in high def so you can view them later at your leisure. Or almost like that. But before we step into the future, let's meet our guide.
My name's pronounced Nicola Twilley. It's kind of a tricky one.
Certainly it is. You step into the future, you don't want a guide with a dull name. This thrill ride begins where Nicola Twilley's New Yorker story began, with a visit to the Salk Institute in San Diego. There she met a biologist named Ron Evans, who introduced Twilley to a couple of mice. Evans called one of them Couch Potato Mouse, and the other one Lance Armstrong Mouse.
Couch Potato Mouse is, frankly, kind of fat. The rolls of fat visible beneath his fur, which is also thinning, kind of greasy looking. Couch Potato Mouse was lolling in the sort of crinkly nest material that they keep in their cages.
This disgrace to all of mousedom had been fed a blend of fat and sugar meant to mimic the average Western diet. He's also been deprived of the opportunity to exercise. No wonder he's lolling. But here's where it gets weird, in a futuristic sort of way. Lance Armstrong Mouse has been fed the same lousy diet, and he hasn't exercised, and...
By contrast, Lance Armstrong Mouse was lean and taut and shiny, and his whiskers were twitching, and he was moving around the cage, sort of snuffling and looking at things. It was sort of shocking.
Shocking is Nicola Twilley's word for it. Mine was weird. Stay with us, then you decide. Ron Evans put the two mice through their paces, and appearances were not deceiving. Lance Armstrong Mouse was almost twice as fast on the mouse track as Couch Potato Mouse. Lance Armstrong Mouse didn't just look better, he was better, just like at the Tour de France, which is kind of a giveaway, isn't it?
Lance Armstrong Mouse had been given this daily dose of a drug called GW501516. And that is what made the difference. That's what gave it its astonishing physique.
That drug's nickname is 516, though biologist Ron Evans calls it exercise in a pill, which suggests that he's a biologist with a sense of humor. But according to Twilley, there's nothing funny or particularly mysterious about how and why 516 works.
If you think about it scientifically, it makes perfect sense. When you move your muscles, the changes that occur, and we know that changes occur during training, they have to be chemical. That's the only way things happen in your body. So if we could only figure out the chemistry of those changes that happen when you train daily or when you lift weights or whatever, then we could give you a synthetic replacement and you wouldn't have to train daily or lift weights.
And you wouldn't look like the human equivalent of sloppy, lolling couch potato mouse. You're intrigued, right? Twilley was. So after she'd met those two mice, she went online and ordered a little 516, all in the name of research, you understand.
It was a liquid form and a little bottle of sort of cloudy, white, watery liquid in a little like hotel shampoo-sized bottle.
Sounds innocent enough, I guess, as long as the little bottle came with instructions.
And then the label amazingly said, see accompanying information for dosage. Well, there was no accompanying information. And it said, prescription only. And then beneath that, it said, not for human consumption, which were two contradictory and not reassuring statements.
Well, yeah, but the guy who sent the stuff probably figured, hey, mice can't read, and who'd feed cloudy white stuff to anything but a mouse? The stuff Nicola Twilley got in the mail, assuming it was the real thing, was first developed a couple of decades ago by a pharmaceutical company looking for something that would reduce cholesterol.
And they tested it on obese monkeys. They discovered that it raised their good cholesterol, lowered their bad cholesterol, lowered their triglycerides, which are bad, lowered their insulin levels. And so they thought they were onto a winner.
A reasonable assumption, especially given that the aforementioned Western diet has created millions of candidates for a drug that does those things. In clinical trials, 516 did all that it was supposed to do in the test rats, but it didn't stop there.
They get the results in from toxicology tests on rats, and they had developed tumors all over their body. They had a hugely increased rate of cancer.
That's not the sort of thing you can gloss over with a rapid-fire warning at the end of a TV commercial, so 516 did not become available to the general public. But labs kept producing it for experimental purposes, and the internet being what it is, Nicola Twilley had no trouble tapping into the market. But she thought that before dosing herself, she'd ask around to see what folks who were using 516 had to say. On the internet, she'd found a fellow who claimed he'd been using the drug for 6 years. He called himself Iron Julius.
He wouldn't tell me his real name. He's a volunteer firefighter, lives in a small town in the south, father of three, and he said, for stamina, there is nothing like it. His wife had tried to get him to do a 5K with her, and he hadn't done any training, and he was thinking he would just have to walk. And he started taking 516, and he ran the whole thing, and he said it blew his mind how good he felt. So he's a fan.
Yeah, okay, Iron Julius, but what about the tumors that popped up all over those rats?
He said, look, everything gives you cancer. You know, no big deal. I'm not worried.
Sound like an endorsement to you? Okay, then. But Twilley wasn't entirely convinced, so she called Tim Wilson, the guy who'd originally designed 516.
And I said, look, I've got this. Shall I take some? And he said, no. So I said, well, you know, why not? And he said, look, you exercise. You don't need this. You also know how to get more exercise if you think that's necessary. The risk-benefit ratio is not right for you. It might be right for someone with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. It might be right for someone who can't walk for whatever reason. It's not a favorable risk-benefit sort of ratio for you. So I put the bottle down again and chickened it, basically.
Or fell back on good sense. I guess it's all in your point of view. As a researcher and writer rather than lab rat, Nicola Twilley also learned that Ron Evans, the guy monitoring Lance Armstrong Mouse, is still trying to develop a less toxic variant of 516. Phase 1 trials with humans have already begun. Other so-called exercise pills are also in the works, but Twilley doesn't see herself as a potential candidate for human trials.
The irony of reporting on an exercise pill was that the more I learned about what exercise actually does and the biochemistry of exercise, the more I thought, you know what? We should just exercise. Exercise is great. There is nothing that is that great for you. So we should just be doing that instead.
I have to agree. But the flying car would still be cool, right? And the machine that would enable you to replay your dreams? Oh, yeah. For much more on Couch Potato Mouse, Iron Julius and 516, I recommend Nicola Twilley's New Yorker story, A Pill to Make Exercise Obsolete. We'll have a link at onlyagame.org. It's time for three stories you should know, and this week we've got stories of scandal, self-sabotage, and disrespect. I'm joined by The Washington Post's Cindy Boren and Mike Pesca. He's the host of Slate's daily podcast, The Gist. Welcome back to both of you.
Hi, Bill.
Thanks for having me back.
Let us delay no further, Mike. You're on.
All right. Scandal. It's the NCAA, but also the FBI have gotten involved, and a slew of players have been named in conjunction with agents paying family members for things as little as meals or possibly $100,000. There are so many scandals in college sports simply because they have an unfeasible model, which is the players are worth millions of dollars, and yet the schools and the institutions refuse to pay them. So, as any economist will tell you, they're going to work around this via the black market. This scandal, though, is so large and affects so many teams. Almost half of the top 25 teams right now are in some way implicated. It seems to me that this could be the case that breaks the NCAA. This could be the case where they say, if we mete out punishments like we normally would mete out punishments, we might have to cancel March Madness. And since March Madness brings us $1 billion in television revenues, maybe we need to question the, I think now in 2018, antiquated notion of amateurism, or as you might want to call it, indentured servitude, that keeps this cash cow a-milking.
Cindy, what do you think? Is what we are seeing on the sports pages every day an actual threat to March Madness if the NCAA doesn't mend its ways?
No. I mean, I wish I believed that, but I've kind of given up on hope. I'm now totally cynical and sad. And, you know, you've also seen the NCAA football players try to unionize, and nothing has really changed. You know, the coaches still make $1 billion each, and the players still get nothing. I mean, President Obama talked about it at the Sloan conference the other day. He didn't have an answer either, but everyone likes to fret about it at this time of year, and I just don't think anything changes.
Mike, I want to agree with you in one respect, at least, that this is bigger than most of the other scandals, or all the other scandals that have come along affecting college basketball. But as long as the NCAA is making money and the TV networks are making money and the most successful coaches and universities with these teams are making money, where is exactly the likelihood that there will be change?
Oh, it could come from a few places. It could come from the kids. I think we're seeing in a major story these last couple weeks that 17-year-olds and 18-year-olds have more power now in the age of social media than they ever did. And I think that we always run the risk of saying nothing can ever change, but history shows us that's not true. It just seems to me that the $1 billion will still be there, and if you cut players in on it, it won't be a travesty for the NCAA. But if you don't do that, the whole thing could come crumbling down.
We're going to move on, Cindy, to self-sabotage. You ready?
Yeah. Oh, I'm ready. Of course, we're talking about tanking. Typically, it's talked about only when a season's coming to an end and a team's looking ahead to the draft. But thanks to our friend, billionaire Mavericks owner Mark Cuban, this has become a real talking point. Adam Silver fined him for daring to tell his players, who are competing for the worst record in the NBA, we're not competing for the playoffs. Losing is our best option. Which is just mind-boggling that you would actually say that. And like Claude Rains, you know, you knew Claude Rains was going to come up in the course of this topic.
Absolutely.
Adam Silver was shocked to learn of this, even though his league has a draft lottery that rewards teams that lose. It was enough to make Silver send a really stern memo to teams and to suggest that maybe it's time to change the lottery.
There are a couple similarities between what the NCAA and NBA are going through. Also, baseball has a tanking problem, although sometimes the teams are just terrible. I mean, let's note that in the NBA, one of these terrible teams, and there are eight teams that have twice as many losses as wins. One of them is the Brooklyn Nets, who don't even have a pick next year. They have no incentive to be bad. They just happen to be bad.
They've traded it away, right?
They've traded away. So maybe the Claude Rains character is the invisible man or the invisible sixth man. Here's what's similar, that the power of suasion or the bully pulpit for both Mark Emmerich and Adam Silver can only go so far. Swagging your finger and saying, don't be a bad boy, means nothing in the face of the overwhelming logic of this tactic. It is just logical for teams to pay a player because you get more than $100,000 or a meal's worth of benefit. And in the NBA, it's just logical to tank. So until Adam Silver does something, like Bill Simmons suggests, a kind of pre-tournament where draft picks are on the line and also playoff spots are on the line, there are creative solutions to it, but saying don't do this tactic that really works, whereby you could build a champion, nothing's going to change.
On Wednesday night, James Harden of the Rockets faked out Wesley Johnson of the Clippers so spectacularly well that Johnson fell down. Harden stepped back behind the three-point line. For a long beat, he looked at Johnson, who was sitting on the floor, and only after Johnson had gotten up and moved toward him did Harden step back and calmly sink a three-pointer.
Oh, he stared at Wesley Johnson, and then he hit the three. Wow.
And then on the way back down the court, Harden put his thumbs under his jersey straps as if to say, look what I did. And the video went nuts, of course. And some commentators have said Harden was showing no respect to his opponent, no respect to the game. I know basketball is a team game. I know I'm supposed to feel outrage when an individual shows up somebody on the other team and showmanship is his major concern. I still thought it was entertaining. In sports, that's supposed to be the point. Do either of you want to argue that James Harden has disgraced himself, the game, his opponents, and the entire basketball world, Cindy?
It was an outrage. No, it really wasn't. It was funny. I thought he was paying his respects to the recently deceased because he stood there looking down, you know, reverentially, like he was remembering good times. You know, he's James Harden. He's head and shoulders above almost everybody else in the game. Someday karma will catch up to him and someone will posterize him or whatever. But right now, it was a bit of entertainment. And I agree with you. Sports should be entertaining.
Mike, were you okay with James Harden's move?
Okay. It was fantastic. I was waiting. I thought he was waiting for the coroner to come in and draw the chalk outline.
Exactly.
This was Michael Corleone offing Salazzo and McCluskey in the restaurant. This was Hannibal Lecter eating his rival with a bit of fava beans and Chianti. I mean, this was all-time classic. And it just goes to show that in game 60-whatever of the regular season, you could have a transcendent moment. I didn't see it live. I didn't see it on a highlight. I just saw a million memes about it. The NBA is really good at social media. James Harden is a cold-blooded assassin, and now everyone knows it.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been The Washington Post's Cindy Boren and Mike Pesca. He's the host of Slate's daily podcast, The Gist, and the editor of the forthcoming book, Upon Further Review, The Greatest What-Ifs in Sports History. Thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Athletes are told that it's about the journey, not the destination. Aspiring Olympians hear that too.
It gets to a point when you're in it so deep, you're like, no, I want that damn destination. Like, I deserve that destination.
Jenny Bender's failed quest to make it, Pyeongchang, coming up on Only a Game from NPR. Our thanks go out this week to GU, who left a review of Only a Game on Apple Podcasts. This is a show that I feel appeals to everyone. Even if you are not into sports, it's the stories that are amazing. Thanks to everybody who's written a review of Only a Game. They really do help other listeners to find our show.
Do you love trivia, puzzles, nerdy games, and humor? What about interviews with actors, musicians, and people from all walks of life? Yeah? Then join me, Ophira Eisenberg, host of NPR's Ask Me Another, every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Bill Littlefield. When you watch the Olympics, you probably think you're watching the best in the world. But when a country sends a large contingent, as the United States does, determining which athletes deserve a ticket to the games can be difficult and subjective. New Hampshire Public Radio's Sam Evans-Brown brings us this story from the sport of cross-country skiing.
Jenny Bender grew up in Vermont, in a family that was not into cross-country. For her first race in seventh grade, she showed up dressed for a cold day of sitting on chairlifts.
I remember being at the start line in alpine like gear, like snow pants and a big old turtleneck. Like, way overdressed next to my fellow competitors on the East Coast that grew up with Nordic skier parents, and they've been in racing in spandex since they were four. I've got a picture from that time that, oh man, it's embarrassing.
But she was good. From 14 years old, she was part of the development pipeline for Olympic skiers. She qualified for junior national championships and then junior world championships. She got a scholarship to ski at the University of Vermont. This was when I met Jenny. I was racing in the Eastern Collegiate Circuit at the same time, but Jenny raced fast enough to be an NCAA All-American. After college, she felt like she could compete on a larger stage, so she started looking around for an elite development team that would help her get there, and landed at one in Minneapolis.
It was a really strong team. I mean, there were times at Nationals when we swept the podium.
In 2012, Jenny finished third in two races at U.S. National Championships. She was a powerhouse, In a sport where results are often inconsistent because of differences in technique or course profiles or wax performance, Jenny was top 10 in almost every race she entered that season. She was performing at or near the same level as the women who are now on the U.S. ski team. But then came that summer.
The skier is created in the summer.
Jenny was at a training camp with her teammates in northern Wisconsin, roller skiing, lifting weights, and running in the woods.
And so I was always the one, like, many times the only one on our team that just sprayed myself with DEET. I was like, I don't care if I get DEET poisoning. I don't want a tick on me.
But sure enough, despite all the bug spray, the last week of training camp, Jenny was feeling off. She was struggling to do her workouts.
I could not do these, like, easy running intervals. And I was like, oh, this is bad. Like, what is going on?
She went to a clinic and got tested and was told she had Lyme disease. Recovery can take a long time. But that wasn't all.
And an hour later that day, I got a call back from the clinic. And they said, Jenny, actually, you also have mono. And I was just like, I was overwhelmed.
Jenny was put on antibiotics and told to rest.
Resting is like prison. It's like the worst. You're like, no, especially mid-season. Like, I was feeling really good and really fit, and I couldn't even really go for a walk. I would go to the end of the driveway, and I would turn around and walk back and just feel drained. And I remember this, I wasn't allowed out in the sun because of how strong the antibiotics were on. I was on a month of antibiotics. I remember sitting in the living room in the dark during the day and just being like, I felt like I was melting into the couch.
This was where Jenny's story and those of her teammates diverge. The fastest racers from the United States, the U.S. ski team, spend their whole winter in Europe racing the World Cup. The domestic racing circuit, where Jenny had been killing it, is kind of like the training grounds for racing in Europe. Now, those women from the Minneapolis team she joined on the podium at national championships, one was Caitlin Gregg, who would go on to win a bronze in the 2015 World Championships. The other was Jessie Diggins, who just this past week was part of a historic Olympic gold medal-winning relay team. Remember, skiers are created in the summer, and Jenny had spent the summer of 2013 melting into the couch and stress-baking. She did manage to start training again in the fall, but when January rolled around, her fitness was only so-so. But still, she showed up at U.S. National Championships, the big stage for skiers who haven't qualified to go ski the World Cup in Europe.
I remember making it into the A final and just being like, I don't know if I can do this. Like, I am so exhausted. The course fit my strengths, and I was raced very tactically, and I out-sprinted a few girls at the end, and I won my first national sprint championship, and I bawled afterwards, and because it was such a, I just was able to do that after all that I just went through, and I'm like tearing up thinking back on that feeling, because that result really saved me in a lot of ways.
Ups and downs would become the theme of Jenny's career. In 2013, she threw out her back, herniated a disc.
And I remember actually having to sit on the ground to get my roller skis on because I couldn't bend over to put them on.
Even so, that year she qualified to go to Europe for the World Cups that came after Sochi, her chance to prove herself with the best in the world and race with the U.S. team. But
a lot of them came back from Sochi with a really bad sickness, kind of the Sochi flu. And then I got sick a couple days later. And that was that trip.
Over the next few years, Jenny was racing very hot and cold. She wasn't having fun anymore. She was so wound up about her results that she was making mistakes, crashing.
Really, universe? Why?
Whenever she made it to the international scene, she wasn't having the results that she wanted.
Really, an athlete will tell you, like, you know, the cliche of it's about the journey, not the destination, which is very true. And it gets to a point when you're in it so deep, you're like, no, I want that damn destination. I deserve that destination. It doesn't help. I'll say it doesn't help.
Jenny always felt a step behind, a step below, as if her whole career she'd been playing catch up. She was just never able to string together enough good finishes to get to and stay at the top international level. Last year, Jenny was finally starting to feel like her old self again. She was once again winning or landing in the top 10 of almost every race she entered. She won a sprint at U.S. Nationals and was now ranked the best sprinter in the country for the fourth year in a row. But the U.S. team is currently loaded with good sprinters. And the rules were changed so that to earn a spot on the World Cup, a domestic racer has to do well in longer races too. So once again, Jenny was passed over.
I was in Bozeman last February. Kind of bummed. I was trying to find my happy again.
She decided to go play a game of pickup hockey. Have some fun.
Of course, no one's wearing a helmet, and someone just decides to slap shot the puck down the ice, and it clocked me in the side of the head. Everyone was like, oh.
Jenny got 5 staples in her head and a serious concussion. But even so, racers have to race. Every so often, Canada gets to host a World Cup. And when they do, the U.S. gets extra start spots. And Jenny was on track to qualify for one. She asked if she could skip the final domestic qualifier, but was told no dice. And she knew that getting that start in Canada would help her to get back over to the European World Cups and maybe to Pyeongchang. So she lined up at the start.
I was standing there with my skis watching my start time tick down. And I was like, no, I have to. Like, I have to. I don't care if I get brain damage. I have to race this race.
She barely did well enough to keep her spot, but says during the World Cup races, she felt like she was just floating along.
Just like, doo-doo-doo. Like, this was a huge event. I should feel something. And I was like, I feel nothing. I was just this shell of a human.
Jenny stopped to reevaluate. The Olympic team for Pyeongchang would be selected in less than a year, and her prospects weren't looking good. The first measuring stick the U.S. team uses is World Cup results. But if you're not on the U.S. ski team, it's hard to get the World Cup starts you need to make it. Criteria number 2 is coach's discretion. For this story, I spoke to a half dozen cross-country skiers who were on the bubble for Pyeongchang. And dissatisfaction with the lack of transparency and how those decisions on discretion were made was the uniting theme in those conversations. So Jenny says she asked the coaches how they would use it.
And they're like, well, like, nah, we're really just looking for standout performances. We're not going to just bring people to bring people.
Jenny was thinking, only 4 athletes can start at each race in the Olympics, and the U.S. team already has at least 5 women who are capable of being in the top 30 in the world on any given day. And she seriously doubted that she could be faster than them. So why would they bring a domestic sprinter? They don't even need any alternates.
They just don't need it. It doesn't make sense.
Jenny decided she had no chance at Pyeongchang in cross-country, and she decided to switch sports. As many cross-country skiers do, she switched to biathlon. That's skiing and shooting.
Because I was like, I really want to make this Olympic goal. The biathlon criteria is clear. They have trials. You know, maybe I can pull this off. I don't know.
Considering that the common wisdom is that it takes 3 years to learn how to shoot, Jenny did pretty well. She qualified for some lower-level competitions in Europe, but not the World Cup. And not the Olympics.
I learned now, like, wow, biathlon is really hard. damn.
And it was while she was over in Europe doing biathlon races that she heard the news. The Olympic team had been announced, and one of the skiers was the current leader of the domestic sprint rankings, a slot that Jenny had been holding consistently for the last 4 years and was told would not be good enough to get her to Pyeongchang.
And I broke mentally, I broke physically. I was like, how is this possible? I felt kind of deceived and lied to, and I bawled. Sometimes there's certain things that make you turn inside out.
It can be a, you know, heartbreaking time for some athletes. They've put a lot into it, and when they don't make it, it can, you know, definitely be a challenge.
The coaches who selected this year's Olympic squad weren't willing to be interviewed, and I should note, I know some of them too. But Luke Bodensteiner is a step above them.
Yeah, my name's Luke Bodensteiner, and I'm the chief of sport for the U.S. ski and snowboard team.
He called me from Pyeongchang. This can get pretty technical pretty quick, but the ski team says they got more spots for Olympic skiers than they anticipated, 20 racers instead of 18. Since only 4 men and 4 women can start each race, they certainly didn't need all of these spots, but if they aren't filled, they're allocated back to other nations, which is against U.S. Olympic Committee policy.
And that gives us an opportunity to enter more athletes in the Olympics than we have before.
So to fill these 2 surprise extra spots, they decided to just go down their ranking list and take the next skiers. And because the next skier happened to be a sprinter, they used discretion to overrule their stated position of only bringing 5 sprinters. Jenny's decision to switch to biathlon was a rational one. based on all the information she had at hand. But because discretion means that coaches can change their minds at the last minute, that rational decision now looks like the wrong one.
I don't want to sound like the bitter athlete that didn't make it. Like, that's, I'm trying to speak up so that this doesn't happen in the future. Suddenly, this life goal that I've had was right there, and the finish line was moved on me.
To be clear, we're talking about spots for alternates. They're the athletes who go over, march in opening ceremonies, hang out for a few days in case someone gets sick or injured, and then go home. If you're the U.S. ski team worried about winning Olympic medals, the stakes here feel pretty low. But when you've devoted your entire life to an obscure sport, hoping that in one of those moments every 4 years that the world turns its attention to what you do, you'll get to be on that stage, it feels pretty important. And it feels pretty personal.
That story was brought to us by Sam Evans Brown. He's the host of New Hampshire Public Radio's excellent podcast, Outside In. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. We'll also have a link at onlyagame.org. Paralympian Oksana Masters was born just 200 miles from the site of the world's worst nuclear accident.
I didn't have a full knee. I had 6 toes. My hands were webbed. Thank God my hair didn't get ruined.
That's just ahead. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
Before we get back to the show, we'd like to ask you about you. That's right. We want to learn more about our listeners with a short survey. It's anonymous and easy. Just go to wbur.org/survey to complete the survey right now. That's wbur.org/survey. This survey will be tremendously helpful to us. So thanks.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, meet John Scott, the massive NHL enforcer who didn't really want to be an enforcer. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
This week, USA Today published a list of the most spectacularly compensated college basketball coaches, 14 of them making over $3 million a year. It only takes Mike Krzyzewski about 4 months to make that much. But I'm assuming all the schools paying this much are getting good value for their dollar, right?
Well, I guess. I mean, otherwise they wouldn't be paying it.
There you go.
But, you know, four of these guys are making over $7 million. Mike Krzyzewski's almost making $9 million. This is a pretty good gig.
I mean,
there's something to be said for an unpaid or barely paid workforce, let me tell you.
Kentucky head coach John Calipari, who makes $7.45 million a year, said this week that college players should have the opportunity to profit from their likenesses and their signatures. Is this in any way connected with the ongoing investigation of college basketball? And if so, how?
It is striking while the iron's hot. I mean, these are two of the less defensible, assuming any of the NCAA's regulations are defensible. These are two of the less defensible. I mean, these are not hills the NCAA should want to die on. Now, there's an equity problem, obviously, between all the members of the NCAA and every school that plays Division I basketball. But these are two fights that the NCAA is doomed to lose. And Calipari, for whom I otherwise have no use, is right about this.
For more than 7 decades, Kentucky basketball has held Senior Day until now, unless the Wildcats will hold some sort of ceremony, including players who might have stayed for 4 years if they hadn't.
Who are already leaving.
There are no seniors there.
Yeah, no seniors on the Kentucky basketball team this year. That's quite amazing, actually.
Beginning this month, the NBA's international developmental camps will include top female players. I don't know if this means we're going to see women playing in the NBA, but maybe the WNBA quality will.
Well, actually, what's most interesting about it is a lot of these camps are going to take place overseas, including in Mexico and Central America and Australia, China, India, and Senegal. I mean, this is really good. I mean, this is the NBA reaching out certainly to improve its brand, but also to give some opportunities to some kids from countries where you're lucky if you can find a basketball, let alone a hoop to throw it through.
Between the Olympics and the Paralympics, the International Olympic Committee lifted the ban on Russia because only two Russian athletes got caught doping at the games in South Korea. So only two Russians, almost clean, good enough. Come on,
man. Yeah, we really showed them, didn't we? Holy Lord.
Program's entirely changed.
It's completely changed, absolutely. Yeah. And you know, it's taking great strides. In fact, bigger strides than it might have taken if it hadn't been pharmaceutically induced. Yeah.
Great big strides.
Big strides.
Tokyo will host the 2020 Summer Olympics, and this week the mascots games were ready. They are spooky, aren't they?
No, they're...
They were revealed to the public, and these mascots, allegedly, can teleport, they can move objects with their minds, and they can talk to stones. So, you good with them?
Well, hey, listen, if they can move things with their minds, these guys are going to wrap up the field events very quickly.
It is said that every great champion needs a great competitor to push him or her to top performances, and Roger Federer would appear to be one athlete who subscribes to that theory.
Yeah, and Roger Federer, by the way, is one of the classiest people who ever played any game anywhere. He won Sportsman of the Year and Comeback of the Year at something called the Laureus Sports Awards. But in his acceptance speech, he paid a very profound and deep tribute to Rafael Nadal, and in fact, barely contained himself while doing so. He's the oldest man ever to be ranked number one in tennis, and he's a remarkable athlete and a remarkable guy. And you're right. I mean, especially in tennis, if you don't have a rival, nobody remembers you. Boxing and tennis, I think, are the two big ones in that regard.
NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell wants Dallas Cowboys owner Jerry Jones to reimburse the NFL $2 million. The league spent the money on legal fees defending itself against Jerry Jones. You know, this is another of those conflicts where it's pretty hard to take sides. Any chance they can both lose?
Yeah, no, it doesn't look like they can both lose, but it is interesting that Roger Goodell looks like he's going to lose a PR war with Jerry Jones, which I didn't think was possible.
Finally, Charlie, the new manager of the Washington Nationals, trotted out a strategy to get the team over the hump of not winning a championship, even though they've reached the playoffs in four of the past six seasons. You know where I'm going. You think inviting camels to spring training will work?
The players seem to like it.
All right.
I mean,
good.
Camels are, by the way, notoriously foul-tempered
they
animals.
They spit.
Yeah, they spit, they bite, they kick at you. He's lucky he didn't lose a player, because that would be a really weird thing to have to litigate through the Players Association.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pearson, Sports Illustrated, from time to time. And, of course, he joins me each week here on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
The 2018 Paralympics are underway in Pyeongchang, and while every Paralympian has overcome challenges, Only a Game's Gary Wallach has the story of one athlete who's faced down more than most.
Oksana Master spent her early childhood in Ukraine.
I don't know why, but I love sunflowers, and I just have this vivid memory of like being in a field of sunflowers and how they felt like trees. They felt so tall.
And for good reason. When she was 7, Oksana stood only 36 inches tall and weighed just 35 pounds. She was malnourished, but that wasn't the only reason she was small. Oksana was born in 1989, about 200 miles from Chernobyl, just 3 years after the nuclear disaster there.
I was missing the main weight-bearing bone in both legs. And my left leg, I didn't have a full knee. It was a floating knee. I had 6 toes. My hands were webbed. And I also have one kidney. I don't have a full bicep on my right side. Thank God my hair didn't get ruined. I could use a little more body, but I'm happy with it.
Oksana's birth mother gave her up for adoption when she was a baby. Life was hard at the three orphanages she lived in, which were situated in the former USSR.
One of the things I remember is like, just that pain in your stomach from when you're really, really hungry and just how to ignore that feeling. And sometimes you go to bed with no meals or just a cup of soup or just bread. And I remember one time sneaking out with a really good friend of mine. Her name was Lainey, and me and her were like each other's family.
Oksana and Lainey left their beds late one night to look for food in the kitchen. Someone heard them. They hid under a table. But Oksana accidentally bumped a chair. Lainey was beaten and taken away.
And I remember asking where Lainey went. Something's wrong. I want to know where Lainey is. And they're like, oh, yeah, she just got sick and ended up dying. But I have a very different memory of that.
Amid this backdrop of abuse and starvation, there was some hope at the orphanage when potential adoptive parents visited. Oksana says she and all the children desperate to leave would wonder, is this my mother? Is this my family? I hope they choose me.
It's weird to not know what a family is, not know what a mother's love is, and not really know what a hug is or anything.
Three families almost adopted Oksana. She's not sure why they didn't. But thousands of miles away, a Buffalo, New York speech pathologist saw a picture of Oksana in adoption agency literature.
It was a terrible black and white photo.
That's Gay Masters.
She's standing in front of a table with a giant Easter bunny on the table, and she's just looking at the camera, and something in her eyes just connected. When I saw her picture, I just knew she was my daughter.
Not long after that, Oksana was shown a picture of Gay.
It was a picture of her passport that the director of the orphanage had, and I asked to look at her picture every single day.
Oksana was soon given her own picture to keep. She'd gaze at it and dream of the day her mom would come for her. After 2 years of red tape and frustration, Gay Masters came to Ukraine. On a freezing cold night in January 1997, orphanage workers woke Oksana from a sound sleep.
They said, Oksana, do you know who this is? And I just see my mom, and she's kneeling down the bed next to me. And I said, I know you. You're my mom. I have your picture. See?
Oksana said that in Ukrainian, a language Gay Masters did not speak, but she understood. 2 weeks later, the new family landed in Buffalo. For the first time in Oksana's life, there was ample food. There were toys and hugs. And there was a new language to learn. Oksana learned her first English words from a dog.
I definitely watched a lot of Scooby-Doo. Jinkies was the biggest one. Or Ruh-Roh.
Within 6 months, Oksana was fooling people. They thought she had always spoken English.
Oksana did well in school. She had a restless energy that drove her to push her physical limits with the help of new prostheses. She climbed trees and jumped off steps with the neighborhood kids.
Everything my mom told me not to do.
And I said, okay, I guess. I don't know what I'm talking about. So you do whatever you want.
Gay looked for safer recreational activities for Oksana.
My mom basically got me into ice skating. Not necessarily get into sports and be competitive, but have an opportunity to move and use your body and make friends, and I fell in love with it.
Oksana also swam and cycled, but her many activities put too much stress on her malformed left leg.
That left leg was very tiny. It was 4 or 5 inches shorter than the other leg. The knee was attached on the side, and the foot was tiny, so she was in a lot of pain.
Doctors had wanted to amputate both of Oksana's legs as soon as she arrived in the States. But Gail had refused to give her approval because she wanted time to bond with her daughter. But the now 9-year-old was suffering. Gay gave the go-ahead to amputate Oksana's left leg.
It was a very smooth, quick transition, and I didn't think anything of that specific amputation. That was the easiest one. And honestly, within a month or 2 months maybe, I was back up and running.
When Oksana was 13, she and Gay moved to Louisville, Kentucky. Gay suggested that Oksana try adaptive rowing, but she resisted.
Finally, I was like, okay, fine, I'll try it, just to kind of get her to stop asking me if I wanted to try it. And so I went out one Saturday, and I fell in love instantly. The minute I got in the boat, it was just a really indescribable feeling to be able to kind of push away from the dock and just be in control. That's something that I feel like was robbed from me in Ukraine.
The look on her face and the joy that she had was like ecstasy.
But when Oksana was 14...
The doctors told me that I would have to get my second leg amputated. And I was just absolutely livid, sad, and frustrated and hurt.
This time, the recovery was more difficult. Oksana spent 4 months in a hospital while her surgical wounds healed. She got back in a boat as soon as she could to once again experience freedom on the water. Then someone mentioned the Paralympics to her.
And I had no idea what the Paralympics was. when I found out about it, I went home, looked it up, and then my competitive nature came out. Like, oh my gosh, I can represent the United States? I can wear a flag on my back? What?
Oksana qualified for the 2012 London Games, pairing up with rower and Marine Corps veteran Rob Jones, who'd lost both legs in Afghanistan. Against all expectations, they won bronze in mixed double sculls. But Oksana suffered a serious back injury in 2013 and was told she couldn't row again. She says she was devastated. She looked for another sport and found cross-country skiing.
It was ugly. Oh my gosh. You would have laughed so much if you saw me try and take five strokes. I fell so much. It broke poles.
But she learned quickly and soon excelled at skiing and biathlon. She won cross-country silver and bronze in Sochi. A year later, she was back in the region on another mission.
I was there to share my story.
Oksana was invited to Ukraine by the U.S. Embassy to promote adoption and disability access in that country. She met Ukrainian soldiers who had lost limbs in the war against Russia. She remembers one group in particular.
When I entered the room, they were like just very bleak face, and I took off my leg and passed it around, and their eyes were like, what just happened? Did she just take her leg off? And once they got to hold my leg and I walked around and show them how I put my leg on and off, and they got to ask questions, they had hope and excitement of what is possible. It's not about what you don't have. It's just about adjusting to your new normal.
Oksana also visited Ukrainian orphanages.
That was very difficult for me because it felt like I was stepping back in a time machine. And this little girl grabbed my hand and just looked up and smiled at me. And I just realized that she doesn't have a home. She doesn't have a mom. And I know exactly what's going through her mind. I know exactly what she's feeling when she grabs my hand and looks up at me. And it was really hard to accept that that's still there, that I'm just one child who made it out, but there's so many more that didn't.
I asked Oksana what she thinks would have happened to her if she hadn't been adopted by Gay.
Honestly, it's a very scary thing to think about because just by one person's decision, my life would be completely different. And honestly, I feel like it would be non-existent.
Gay Masters could have adopted a child from just about anywhere, but she insisted upon adopting Oksana.
It's very easy to look into someone's eyes and see their soul and get that connection. And my mom has always said she's fallen in love with my eyes, all based on a picture, saw it, and said, that's my daughter.
Right now, Gay Masters' daughter is in Pyeongchang for the 2018 Paralympics. She's scheduled to compete in cross-country skiing and biathlon. Gay hopes Oksana can accomplish something she hasn't yet.
I would love it if she could get a gold medal, not because I need her to get a gold medal, but because I know that's the one thing that's been beyond her reach.
I want to put it around my mom, around her neck, because she is why I'm here, even living my dream, and why I'm able to cross a finish line.
Oksana's gold medal dreams were put in jeopardy when she slipped on some ice and dislocated her elbow just a couple of weeks before the games. We wish her all the best in Pyeongchang. Our story was produced by Only a Game's Gary Wallach. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Dave Sousa. And our senior producer is Karen Gibbon. Our final word comes from Oksana Masters, who recently went to the Ukraine to visit with injured soldiers.
I just remember the hug from this one guy who was just beaming from ear to ear. And they kind of joked on him because they're like, ah, you're a pretty girl. That's why he's so happy.
I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. And thank you for listening.